What does it mean to be a Christian historian? Can there be such a thing as Christian history? In his new book, Christian Historiography, Five Rival Versions, published by Baylor University Press in 2015, Dr. Jay Green of Covenant College explores these and other related questions. Dr. Green manages to both objectively present different approaches to Christian historiography while providing his own helpful valuations of their strengths and weaknesses gained through years of study and teaching. Dr. Green's own approach, combined with his clear writing style and the tight organization of his book, means that this work is not only of interest to historians, both Christians and non-Christians, but would be perfect for classroom use by undergraduates and graduates as well. I hope you'll enjoy the interview. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Jay Green about his new book, Christian Historiography, Five Rival Versions. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Franklin. It's good to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So I wonder if you could begin by just telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I teach history at Covenant College, which is located on Lookout Mountain, Georgia, but it is a suburb of Chattanooga, Tennessee, and a Presbyterian school. And I'm in my 19th year teaching history, and small liberal arts college with about 1,000 students. So I kind of have to be a bit of a jack of all trades. So I teach a wide variety of things, but teach American. A variety of courses in American history, some non-Western courses in modern Middle East, and then courses in sort of historical methods and, of course, historiography.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, and that's what we were talking about, right, in the pre-interview. You're doing this, you know, a lot of neat courses where you do the kind of introductory to history, but also, as you said, this is a Presbyterian university, so you get to do kind of, like, what'd you call it, a foundations class?
Yeah, I also, a course that students at Covenant are required to take really at the very beginning, that it sort of introduces them to the life of the mind kind of from a Christian perspective, and kind of an introduction to the way a school like Covenant engages the world of ideas. So it really is a lot of fun. Plus it's very multidisciplinary, and you have an opportunity to sort of walk alongside students, many of whom this is utterly brand new stuff. So yeah, that's a lot of fun.
Right. It kind of reminds me, it's funny, when I teach world history, some, you know, I teach about ancient Judaism, and of course, soon I'm going to, well, actually tomorrow I'll be talking about the rise of Christianity in Rome. Mm. And it's interesting, because even though we're in kind of the Bible Belt, and whenever I do, like, I'll sometimes do like an anonymous religious survey, a lot of the students, even though they're very firm in their belief, they don't really know much.
Oh, that's for sure.
I'll make Bible references and they won't.
Yeah, and I always remind students of that whenever I'm teaching Islam. In the modern Middle East, they said, look, you have to remember that if you're asked to sort of account for the long history and the theological fine points of Christianity, you might be a little stumped, and you need to remember that probably people around the world are simply because they identify with a particular religion doesn't mean they're as deeply versed in it as you might think.
Right, exactly. So it's interesting. You mentioned, you know, that at your university, there's this, you know, it's a university, it's teaching knowledge, but it also has this kind of foundations class.
Yes.
And so in your and that's one thing I really enjoyed about your book, is you're trying, you're engaging with this issue of historiography, but from a Christian perspective.
Right. Right.
So go on.
No, go ahead. You were teeing up for a question.
Oh yeah. So I was just curious, how did you come to write this?
Well, it's a good question. I went to a Christian college and was a history major, and I've loved history since I was a little kid. But in all honesty, I felt more than anything like I was simply learning a bunch of facts, and more than anything, studying so I could do well maybe one day on Jeopardy. And it wasn't until the tail end of college, and more than that, when I started into my master's program, that it occurred to me that people really did engage the world of history interpretively in some very different ways depending on their gender, their social location, and their religious convictions. And I became kind of both fascinated and at times a little unsettled by the degree to which my own reading of history was affected by those things. So I did a lot of reading and ended up exploring pretty deeply in my master's program problems and challenges of Christian historiography. And it's just really been, as I have developed as a believer myself and as a professional historian, trying to bring these two things together and trying to be faithful to both has just kind of been a constant theme, kind of personally and professionally. So when I came to Covenant, I was pleased to see that, unlike my own undergraduate training, Covenant was pretty self-consciously trying to induct students into the world of historiography in a broad sense, but also helping them develop a more sort of faithful Christian response to history. And we have a junior level course that is on historiography, which is basically a typical history of history, exploring the various accounts of what history is, the rise of sort of a scientific methodology of history as its own discipline that is trying to, as Leopold von Ranke talked about, you know, trying to understand history as it actually happened. But then the last third of the course, we spend a fair amount of time exploring the various ways that Christians have understood history and have at times tried to develop something of, at times, a unique kind of Christian take on history. So I've taught that course for years, and it really is a signature course for our major and has become really a course that I love doing because it really it's very personal, and it really does try to have students take a deeper ownership, certainly of history, but even of their faith. So in doing that course and developing kind of an effort to explain this, I had an opportunity to have a sabbatical 5 or 6 years ago, and I looked around and I thought, you know, I wonder if this outline that I've been using in historiography to explain what I began to see as kind of a very specific approaches, or as I call in the book, versions of Christian historiography, whether or not that might actually make a valuable book. So I started working on it, and I was pleased that it sort of came together as such.
Well, I think you did make a valuable book. I really got a lot out of it. What was your hope then that this book would do?
Well, I wrote, my primary audience was fellow believing historians who were engaged in the work of scholarship, but trying at some level to grapple with questions of faith and, first of all, trying to discern whether there was any relationship at all between one's personal identity as a Christian, one's practices of Christian faith, and one's sort of moral responsibility to live as a Christian in the world, any relationship between that and sort of the professional calling to produce scholarship. And so I wanted to say, well, if you're going to engage in this question, a book that at least lays out what have been the approaches tried might be a useful starting point. So that was my primary audience, sort of fellow Christians. And, well, frankly, my initial audience were my students. So, but as I was working on the book, I thought both of them, but also of colleagues and so forth who would be writing. I'm aware that to the extent that historiography is kind of a species of intellectual history, there are probably a fair number of non-believing historians who might find it at least a curiosity to know that there's this sort of intramural conversation happening among believers about questions of interpretation and application of sort of background commitments to the world of scholarship. So I thought, you know, there may be some intellectual historians out there who just find this at least a curiosity, if not a challenge in its own right.
Right. Well, I think they will hopefully find it interesting, because sometimes I know, like, if I go to the American Academy of Religion, there's this kind of attempt at times to basically, through lots and lots of primary research, to do what you've done in a nice, neat little package.
Oh, well, I hope that that's the case. And the book is, in all kinds of ways, I just did a lot of reading and tried to put the various strategies of people who are Christians writing history into some boxes that might at least function as an organizing principle. So in certain ways, if there's any originality to the book, it certainly isn't in its, maybe it's in the arrangement of an already existing and quite vibrant conversation.
Right. And as part of this conversation, you raise some of that there's unique problems that Christian historians face that more secular historians don't. Could you tell us a little bit about those problems?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I think there's an initial challenge to discern whether or not this question even matters, because there's a certain way of living out faith that thinks of it primarily as a personal matter, a matter that is certainly relevant to eternal questions of salvation and moral formation and family relations and certain personal and probably even professional ethics. But whether or not the questions of faith bear on the actual day-to-day work of reading sources, in selecting and analyzing and writing about the past, whether or not it really matters at all. So I think that question all by itself is something that I'm guessing there's some really thoughtful, faithful believers who are first-rate historians who, frankly, don't care. And I don't think that they necessarily are bad Christians or poor historians for not doing so, but I also wouldn't mind sort of nudging them to at least consider what some of the ways in which faith perspectives, even unconsciously, are shaping what they're doing. So I think that's one. I think that's one factor that's at play. I would say another one is the ways in which Christianity is it's at once timeless, universal, and supra-historical, but it is also very much a faith that is highly reliant on the record of the past. I mean, Jesus lived as a man in a particular time, in a particular place, and the revelation of Jesus as we know it, both in his person and through Scripture, has unfolded in real time. So I think that there are some, as a distinctly historical faith, trying to wrestle with questions of timelessness and universality, but also time-boundedness and particularity, really are deep and perhaps even vexing questions that historians, this is kind of where historians live. So in certain ways, I do believe just ignoring those or pretending like they're not there is well, maybe not advisable. I think it's something we probably, as Christians, ought to at least be challenging one another on. So I think that the dynamics that are found probably to some degree in all of the chapters and all of the options that I lay out in the book, those tensions are kind of ever present.
Right. And speaking of the layout, I mean, for our listeners, this book is very logically laid out, which makes my job as an interviewer very easy, because there's five rival versions. Well, there's five chapters.
Oh, what do you know?
Yeah. And Jay does a great job of explaining what each version is and what its strong points are and what its weak points are. So I think that, you know, this is one thing that I highly recommend it for your own reading, but also this makes it great for classroom use, right? Because our students can pick it up, I think, more easily.
Yeah, and that's really what I wanted, and I'm guessing its primary audience will be found within a classroom setting where you do have undergraduates or maybe seminary students or graduate students trying to think through kind of in a logical way that there are different, at times competing, but I think overlapping options of the ways in which this question of faith has sort of worked itself out within scholarship. So I'm glad you found it to be at least a helpful organization.
No, it's fascinating. So if we start then with the first chapter, which is entitled Historical Study That Takes Religion Seriously, could you tell us a little bit, what is this approach?
Yeah.
This approach?
I would say that this approach, I'm a member of, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Conference on Faith and History, and it shows up at a few places within the book, but this is a professional organization of historians who are believers, and it's meant to be historians of all kinds who happen to be Christians, but it is overwhelmingly it's dominated by historians who study religion, and I think that's it's not surprising that believers who go into history are probably have a disproportionate attraction to study religion and to study themselves. And I think an initial and in some cases somewhat non-controversial way of expressing faith within history is to elevate religion as a factor within the past as a meaningful factor. It matters. It's significant. It's played a role in shaping institutions and cultures and nations. And I think acknowledging that it's a real factor, it's not sort of a false set of convictions or actions that have maybe in a Marxian sense underlying material or economic values, but it matters and it's a factor unto itself is one way, and I think a way that is, as I said, relatively non-controversial way for Christians to exercise and express faith commitments in doing history. And I think probably a generation ago, this was a harder sell. Religion was not as commonly studied within history, or if it was, it was kind of off to the margins. And I don't know what your read on this in some of the areas that you study, but probably beginning in the 1980s and certainly 1990s, religion just becomes extraordinarily popular as a field of study. And certainly a whole lot of people who are studying it have no faith commitments whatsoever. But some of the leading historians, at least in history of American religion and American Christianity, are themselves Christians who are motivated in part to demonstrate that religion has mattered and that religious ideas have been consequential. So I kind of start there in the book, partly due to the fact that it is it has been, I guess we could think of it as low risk. You can advocate that religion matters and you can take religion seriously without being perceived as trying to sneak Christian ideas or offer an alternate Christian interpretation within history. So I think that it's a widely shared notion. It's one that I don't think you're going to find many Christians anywhere who would find it disagreeable. And it's, as I said, it's low risk in the sense that you can be fully accepted within the guild and not be perceived as special pleading on behalf of your, you know, pet theological ideas or your own sort of religious agenda.
Right. And so what other, I mean, that's a very good point that, you know, kind of a strong point, right? Like you said, you can be safe as a Christian kind of looking at this perspective. Are there any other strong points to this approach?
Well, I think it does offer Christians who are in some ways wanting to make sense of their own faith or wanting to show it as being authentic, just a place to demonstrate. Now, I use an anecdote in one of the chapters of the book where a historian was writing, who was a non-believer, writing about Timothy Dwight, who was a president of Yale College back, I think, at the very beginning of the Second Great Awakening. And I think Stephen Burke was the name of the historian. And he began the research project as not a believer himself, but through the process of seeing Dwight's personal convictions and the ways in which they played out in his life, he admits that through the process of writing the book, he himself was converted, that Dwight had sort of one last convert from the grave, or maybe not the last one, but certainly a late one. And it is an interesting thing. And not everybody who studies religion in the past necessarily takes it seriously in the same way. But I think that acknowledging that it plays a vital role and that it is not reducible, as I think a lot of secular ideology still would suggest, reducible to characterological traits or economic impulses or something of that sort, but that it is kind of an independent variable, I think can be kind of a compelling point and one that I think still can be can offer kind of an interesting kind of witness. Now, I don't think that people who take religion seriously very often do so as a way to bear witness to Christian faith, but I think it's sort of it can be a natural way of doing so.
Right. And so then, I mean, those are the strong points. And one thing I like about your book is that you do a great job of kind of objectively explaining the characteristics of these different approaches. And then you then show in your judgment as a historian what you think are the good and bad points. I think you balance that very well. So you said the strong points. What do you think are some weak points of this approach?
Yeah, well, I think the weak points are, as much as I said taking religion seriously matters and we should take religion seriously as an independent variable, I also think that in the complexity of life, religion very often is a negative force and is a tool and a weapon in the hands of tyrants and those who are seeking to do harm. So I think it's valuable, and I think it does offer one pathway of giving expression to Christian faith. But I think the ways that it's done are various and not all equal. So I think it's one that I think just needs to be looked at advisedly. I also think that if this is the sum and substance of what it is to be a believer, I think I mentioned the Conference on Faith and History, which for many feels like when we have meetings, some will say it's just another meeting of the American Society of Church History. And I think my colleagues who do economic history or do agricultural history or, you know, do diplomatic history of some sort are kind of perplexed to think, well, religion is interesting, but there's a lot of other things that are interesting as well. Do I am I required to study religion in order to be a Christian historian? Are there other ways of doing that? Or do the conversations among Christian historians don't pertain to me if this isn't my thing? So I think that in some respects, it's an embarrassment of riches that we have so many believing historians who have devoted themselves to studying religion, but it almost at times seems to suggest that there really isn't anything worth studying, or at least there isn't anything worth studying Christianly that doesn't have an explicit religious component. So I think it can I guess that would be kind of an important limit.
Right. So another approach that you took is in chapter 2, and the chapter titles are very helpful. Historical study through the lens of Christian faith commitments. Could you tell us what does that approach entail?
Yeah, this is an approach that is pretty strongly, at least it was initially, related to a Reformed theological, and some might even go so far as to say a Kuyperian understanding of reality that suggests that our identity as believers and the mission of God in the world is comprehensive. It doesn't just affect our individual spiritual lives, but it affects all reality. As Kuyper sort of famously said, that Jesus looks on every square inch of creation, he declares it mine. So it's a notion that says, just as Jesus that Christ claims all of reality is his, as believers, we are to bring a Christian understanding and witness to bear on all things. Another thing that Kuyper was interested in developing was, in light of that, was kind of a very specific and unique Christian reading and engagement of all of life and all things. So it kind of works on the premise that being transformed by Christ and having a Christian identity causes Christians to see the world differently through different lenses. I think the Christian worldview movement was largely a result of sort of this Kuyperian understanding. So this approach kind of departs from the notion that all Christians have to offer is sort of a take on religious factors in the past, but that as Christians, because we see the world differently, we're going to have sometimes a slight, maybe a radically different way of seeing all reality. Probably the most influential proponents of this view have been those out of the Reformed tradition, particularly George Marsden. And I think if anybody is familiar at all with the conversation of faith and history, are going to know who that is, or might be somewhat familiar with some of his writings. Very prominent historian, now emeritus from University of Notre Dame, who really tried to unpack this and tried to explain some of the ways in which what he called background faith commitments inform and shape the historian's work, so that we don't believe that our faith is over here and our scholarship is over here. Our faith is sort of working as a foundation, as a background, and it kind of has a shaping influence. He wasn't radical in his conviction that Christians could either, as a result of that, do history in a superior way, or because we were Christians, we did history better. But he said it was a factor and an influence. And by the way, he said it isn't just Christians who see reality differently. All people operate with background assumptions that inform what they see. So part of what he was doing was trying to raise to the level of consciousness the various ways in which personal identity and even social location are a factor in causing us to see the world differently. So he kind of, his argument really came to light in a postscript to a book he wrote back in 1992 on the ways in which the university had become secularized and the ways in which religion as a personal set of commitments and really as a presence in the modern university had grown marginalized. And he made a play in the postscript of the book to say that the university discourse had become impoverished by its marginalization of religious viewpoints, not just Christian ones, but ones of all stripes. So he kind of lays out this, and the book kind of hit the scene at the same time as philosophy and history and literature departments are kind of in the throes of postmodernism. So really, in all kinds of ways, is a part of that conversation that is suggesting that there is no sort of neutral, enlightenment, detached way of seeing reality, that all scholarship is informed by faith perspectives. So this chapter really does try to explore some of the prominent advocates of this view and some of the ways in which their views have been explored and applied.
So what then recommends this approach?
Well, there's a certain kind of, I think, truthfulness that comes in, and he even says so in the postscript, and he admits he had tenure. It was for him kind of a low risk thing, but he says, look, I'm writing about largely Protestant people throughout American history. I just need to, for the sake of my audience, give some full disclosure to know that even though I'm trying as best I can to be fair and trying to honestly read these sources, it probably would be useful for the audience to know that I'm a Christian and I'm a pretty traditional one, and it probably influences what I see and how I describe what I see when I study the past in ways that I'm not even conscious of. So for him, it was a matter of intellectual honesty, but also one that he thought Christians would do well to be more conscientious of. And because I think he was also a big believer that faith, as much as faith sheds light, it can also obfuscate. So he saw it as a measure of intellectual honesty and a way to sort of tamp down the notion that we function as detached, neutral ciphers who are just sort of reading the past in some sort of pure way.
So what then are the problems with this approach?
Well, there was a bit of a backlash to Marsden followed that postscript up with a book about 5 or 6 years later called The Outrageous Idea of Christian Scholarship, where he took this idea of background faith commitments and he sort of tried to understand how he delved into them more deeply and talked about them not just in history but kind of across the board, and you know, whether it's in biology or in political science or psychology. And it was a very thoughtful and challenging approach, and a good many people were having none of it. And I think the approaches or the responses kind of were of two kinds. One were suspicious that Christians had controlled the academy for generations and in all kinds of ways had made, from a lot of people's point of view, were marginalized other voices and were repressive. And there was a bit of a fear that the likes of Morrison, in trying to assert the legitimacy of Christian voices, there was a concern that there wasn't going to be an attempt at a re-Christianization of the academy, which might feel even, you know, 20 years later, a little bit laughable. But still, there was a concern that this idea had been tried and it wasn't necessarily for the good. I think a more serious set of – not that that wasn't a serious critique, but another one was concerned that for as much as Christians wanted to talk about a Christian reading of biology or of psychology or of even history, they wanted to say, where is this thriving body of knowledge that you can call a Christian body of scholarship? And where, in what important ways, is it really all that different? A lot of people looked at Morrison and said, your history, for as much as you talk about your Christian background commitments, it doesn't seem to be netting scholarship that looks all that different from your secular colleagues. Is this really amount to anything? Is it really valuable? And I think now maybe it's too soon to tell, but I do think that that's a worthwhile criticism. That do we just talk about it as a factor, but in the end product, if we can't see anything that looks discernibly and distinctively unique and departing or recognizably Christian, what's it amount to? I think the comparison is sometimes made to Marxist historiography, which is another sort of ideologically framed set of assumptions. And a lot of people said, now that's a tradition that has netted a body of scholarship that is discernible. You might not agree with it, but it is it's unique and distinctive and offering up a very different way of seeing the world. And there hasn't been as much people haven't been nearly as convinced that the approach Morrison has taken has been capable of doing that.
Right. Excellent. Now, your next chapter, being someone who studies Asia, who studies Confucius a lot. Oh. I love the next chapter, especially historical study as applied Christian ethics.
Yeah.
So what does this approach entail?
Yeah, well, this is the next three chapters, I think, begin to depart a little bit from what we might think of as traditional professional scholarly orthodoxy. I mean, Marsden was really trying to make a play for Christian background commitments, but was simultaneously, which was probably part of the critique, trying to also convince people that Christians were not a danger to academic discourse, that we could play well with others. Starting in this third chapter, we see a much more explicit difference that Christians might make in offering not just the idea that religion matters or that there are background, kind of generic background commitments that are informing faith, but that Christians bear some responsibility to offer a moral critique of the people of the past. And this kind of harkens back to almost a pre-Enlightenment, history. In some respects, doesn't really become its own discipline until the 19th century, but a very old, even ancient understanding of history saw history as kind of the teacher of life, or as kind of philosophy teaching by examples. So, and honestly, I think people outside the academy are much more comfortable with this idea that, you know, why do we study history? Well, we want to learn from the past. We want to gain moral insight and look at history as a series of moral tales of good guys and bad guys, of villains. and heroes. And so for many, doing history Christianly means offering up kind of a template of Christian ethics taught through example. And I think that that's certainly one approach where we kind of bring Christian moral categories to bear on the past. Now, I think anyone who's trained as a professional historian already maybe starts getting a little bit uneasy because one thing that I was trained in graduate school and I'm guessing you may have had some similar advice that our role as historians isn't to judge the past, but to describe it. But there's a significant body of writing and some of it by professionals, a lot of it by non-professionals who are writing history as kind of an exploration of and even a moral critique on the past.
Right. So one thing you mentioned was that, you know, this, especially people outside of academia, this is something that seems very natural. And I know when I teach my introductory world history class, I do sometimes fall into the good guy things, like when I'm talking about Cincinnatus, because I think he is a good guy.
Yeah.
I think he's someone we can learn from. And I notice those are times when the students are really interested. So, I mean, I think that is kind of a strong point. Are there any other strong points there?
Well, I think it's sort of there's something natural about it. I'm the same way. This isn't even a Christian, but when I teach my historiography class, one of the readings my students like the most is Howard Zinn. Zinn's People's History of the United States, or People's History of America, whatever the title is. And Zinn is someone who is – he comes right out at the beginning and says – you know, history is a moving train. There's no good reason to pretend that we are morally neutral. There are great evils, and if we're not doing history with an eye toward rooting them out and calling out the, in his case, those who are abusing the marginalized and the, you know, people who are oppressed by government abuse and corruption, then why are we doing this? And it certainly gives my students a sense of that history can be courageous and it can do real and legitimate work in the world. And so I find it to be certainly understandable. And I think there are times when the general practices of technical history that tries to resist taking sides and tries to merely describe can be, I found it at times even to be spiritually harmful, because I come to the end of it, it's like, do I even have a conviction? Is this, am I so interested in being nuanced and careful that I'm no longer able to sort of feel rage when I see injustice and abuse. So in that respect, it maybe calls out some of what is dehumanizing about traditional historical scholarship, in that, yeah, as humans studying a human drama, if you're not in some way moved, then maybe you're not doing it right, or maybe you're not thinking carefully enough about it.
Excellent point. So with those strengths, then what are the weaknesses?
Well, the weaknesses are, I think that if we are, I think very often we move to the past with an already determined moral framework, which sort of invites us to morally or to manipulate the past so as to create the dynamics of good and evil, bad guy versus good guy that we've already determined prior to even engaging the past. And I think one of the really good insights of traditional scholarship that urges the historian to resist that is it keeps ever before us the fact that good night, the human drama is too complicated for easy reductions of the past to simple moral fables. I think there's something that by pushing back on it, I think we sometimes do so for good moral reasons, because the world is much grayer than that, and we ourselves are sometimes much more complicit in the world's evils than we allow ourselves to be. So I think it diminishes the historian's role as a simple moral arbiter and says, look, if we want to respond to the tragedies of the world appropriately, the very first task we have as historians is to understand what really happened. And sometimes that means resisting the urge to judge, at least or at least holding off on the tendency to judge a little longer until we've seen more, until we've understood how things play out, until we see a little more the ways in which people that were initially thought of as evil are a whole lot more like us than we thought at first blush.
Right. So then you had said that, you know, we're kind of moving away from more academic styles of historiography, and that's, I think, definitely true in Chapter 4. Historical study is Christian apologetic.
Yeah.
So what's that?
Well, of course, Christian apologetics is the sphere of Christian thinking that has as its end the defense of the truth of Christianity. And I think there are a couple of different ways in which history functions within that area, that if Christianity is true, that we need to contend for the faith, we need to demonstrate that the faith is in fact true. And many are moved to study history because as an historical faith, its truthfulness requires us to defend, for instance, that Jesus actually lived and that he did the things that he said he did, that the account of Jesus that we find in the Bible is valid, particularly things like the resurrection. And so that's one area and one that I spend much less time on in the book, but an important one, where in contending for the historicity of Christian faith, we are doing work not simply that is straightforward historical scholarship, but that also bolsters our confidence in the very foundations of what we believe. And I think that part of it is probably less controversial than the part that I spend probably the balance of the chapter on, which is the tendency to write about Christianity in the past in a way that conveys to readers that Christianity not just is true from its foundations, but that as it moved and unfolded through time, made the world a better place. And so it's kind of an approach to studying history that tries to persuade people of the truthfulness of Christianity by showing that it works, that where Christianity has rooted itself in cultures and in people's lives, it has improved the world immensely. So you find a whole literature out there that gives Christianity credit for everything from capitalism to democracy to compassion to science. And it really is done in such a way as to say, look, and you can understand in a highly secular age where Christianity gets beat up on a lot for its for what's perceived to be its failings. A lot of these books come along and say, were it not for Christianity, the many of the good things that we think of as associated with modernity and civil society and the rule of law, et cetera, would not be here were it not for Christianity. So it's an approach to history that sees as its task making Christianity, really defending the honor of Christianity and seeing it as a valid work. So that's kind of what I take up for the majority of this book. I'm sorry, of this chapter.
So what are the strong and weak points of this approach?
Well, again, and this is kind of a theme for these three chapters. It makes very good sense that people would feel moved to defend, as I said, put it kind of in a colloquialism, and to kind of defend the honor of Christianity. And I do think it's not hard to find kind of what function as apologetic works coming the other direction that have an axe to grind against Christian faith. I think the writings of the new atheists that were particularly talked about a lot a few years ago, and you can even go back as far as looking at the work like someone like Edward Gibbon from the 18th century, really were interested in seeing Christianity as the root of all evil, the source of violence, the source of divisions, of civil war. And so the motivation of trying to say that's not the whole story, or that Christianity has done far more good in the world than not, is understandable. And I think a natural inclination. So on all three of these approaches that I talk about in chapters 3, 4, and 5, I'm very sympathetic to the motive and understand why the kinds of writings that are generated out of these traditions are very compelling, especially to lay readers, because it affirms what they believe is the best parts of Christian faith, and it sees Christian faith or history is doing something of substance, doing something, as I said, like the Howard Zinn did for in his writings, doing something good in the world. So I'm sympathetic to that.
So what then are the weak points of this approach?
Well, I think the weak points to I think the weaknesses are, again, it invites a kind of source mining so as to find elements within the past that support an already pre-existing way of understanding the world. And I think, look, in the end, I honestly don't believe that arguments and debates over the truthfulness of Christianity are to be fought in the sphere of history. I don't think the truthfulness of the witness of Christ is in the end reliant on how well Christians have been in making the world a better place. Because Christians have a lot of blood on their hands, and a lot of the things that Christians have done are kind of less than noble. So I think it's a dangerous sphere to get into, and I think it can do more harm than good. I think I'd much rather see an approach to history that is willing to look at kind of warts and all, and acknowledging errors and failures rather than looking at Christian faith as always offering good, because I just don't think it's, in the end, I don't think it's honest. And I think it obscures more than it reveals.
Right. So then moving on to the last chapter before your conclusion, historical study is the search for God. This is the one that I kind of felt your passion the most. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that approach and why this was such a passionate chapter.
Well, this is a tricky one because I think I describe this approach. Of course, this is an approach to history that is sees God as the author of history, and the historian's primary task is tracing God's hand moving events forward. And I think if you ask sort of a man on the street kind of approach, like what would make history done Christianly unique, I think this would be the most common sense response, that Christian history is history that includes God and God's presence. And I understand that and am sympathetic to it. And I think it's particularly compelling when we teach our children about history and want to bolster their faith by reminding them that God is present in all things and even in control of all things. It becomes problematic and probably a source for my own concern and even, as you said, passion, because I think it too easily conflates the doctrine of providence, which I think we should affirm as believers, that is, that God is in control, sovereign over all human activities at all times and all places, with our ability to know what God is doing and see what he's doing and narrate that. I think those are two very different things. And I think when we conflate them, we get into a lot of trouble. I think people's motives for doing so, especially with children, are well placed, because what it's really about is it's less about studying the past than it is about building faith and trying to reinforce the convictions that we have about the doctrine of providence by looking at, you know, the unfolding of the American story or the defeat of the Spanish Armada or something like that. I find it to be so rife with the possibility for abuse, not just of the record of the past, but also the name and the intentionality of God. That I think it's a very dangerous place to be. So I think that by engaging in this providential approach to history, I think that we set ourselves up to, in certain ways, see things from God's point of view in ways that we simply can't. Scripture probably spends as much time talking about the ways in which God's purposes and ends are shrouded from us in mystery than it does by revealing specifically what those intentions and actions are. So it's a dangerous terrain, but it's one that's still pretty popular and ones that I think Christians who are doing history have a responsibility for being able to both sympathize with, but also articulate where that approach can be problematic.
Excellent. So, you know, you've taken us through the five chapters, you've given us these kind of five approaches, telling us their strongest points and their weakest points. And then in the conclusion, you kind of, talk about your own perspective on this and you subtitle your conclusion, historical study as Christian vocation. So could you tell us a little bit what you mean here by vocation, and how does treating historical study as a Christian vocation affect how Christians do history and the histories they produce?
Yeah, well, I couldn't decide whether thinking of history through the lens of the theological exploration of vocation was a sixth approach, that is, its approach unto itself, or even possibly just an umbrella way of talking about the full, any conscious effort to bring faith and history together. And I kind of didn't try to resolve that, because I think both ways of thinking about that are appropriate. I guess more than anything, what I saw in the last now you can take an approach to vocation that simply says I'm not going to think at all consciously about faith. I am, as a faithful believer, simply going to do good work. I'm going to produce good scholarship. I'm going to be fair-minded in my use of the sources. I'm going to be thoughtful and conscientious in interacting with colleagues and scholar or students. And you know, if I have opportunities on the side to bear witness, fine. But that's not really that's separate from my work. So that is actually one approach to vocation that says, you know, all the rest of the stuff you've talked about, you can kind of just set it aside and just do good work. I'm not satisfied with that, but I do think that another, I think, richer understanding of vocation, more than anything, is nudging believers to, in taking their faith seriously and in desiring to be faithful in it, to consider actually all of these approaches and some of what they have to recommend and some of the areas in which they fall short, and kind of being in conversation with others in trying to work this stuff out. This is it's too important an endeavor, that is, understanding the past, understanding ourselves in light of the past, to imagine that it's just something we do as, you know, in our work as professionals, and not something that has a larger set of consequences for, well, for all of humans, but in particular, we who are disciples of Jesus. So this idea of vocation sort of is a nice sort of way of sort of, at least maybe it's a good place to begin. We should begin it there and work backwards. I don't know, but a way to sort of bring one another into conversation on these issues.
And as kind of a question before the final question, one thing that just occurred to my mind as I read your book is it's kind of thinking about what the historian does for others, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, how might the study of history help a Christian work out his or her own salvation? I'm thinking of Philippians 2:12.
Yeah, I was glad that you kind of sent that to me as a question for me to think about ahead of time. I really was struck by that. And I think there's probably been a lot of debate about what Paul might have meant. What an interesting idea that for as much as the truth of faith and the invitation to salvation and a life of discipleship is laid out in Scripture, Paul presses the reader to, you know, work out your own salvation in fear and trembling. I think that is a helpful picture of the challenges of grappling with our circumstances and our callings and our responsibilities in time and space in ways that feel both on certain days satisfying and on other days incredibly frustrating. And I think that is true of the work of the historian, to understand the complexities and the blind spots that we work with, the incomplete and sometimes contradictory record of the past that we're trying to make sense of, but also recognizing that in our calling to sort of wrestle through these challenges and issues, to do so, doing so is a part of more deeply understanding ourselves and deeply understanding the world in which God has called us to live out our lives. So I think I talk to my students a lot about that history is little more than an organized approach to remembering. And the Bible has a lot to say about memory and remembrance as a pathway of faithfulness. And I do think that we do not have I think we have a very impoverished sense of ourselves and our calling as believers if we don't have a dynamic understanding of the unfolding of the past, kind of in a grand sense, but even in a more immediate one. And I think that picture of us sort of working out our salvation in fear and trembling, I think is a good one for the challenges that accompany that daily pursuit of trying to be faithful in our very I think we have some faulty remembering equipment, and I think it hopefully that enables us to strive toward some of these goals with a certain degree of humility.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you very much for that reflection. And we've taken a lot of your time, but I'd like to ask to just take a little bit more so I can ask our traditional last question. What are you working on now?
Well, I have been for the last several years, I just mentioned this project on memory. I have been trying to sort of explore the larger human practice of public remembrance, sort of strategies of remembrance, and I've been trying to hammer out at least the beginnings of another book. We'll see how that unfolds. But I am interested in this tension between our longing to be remembered and the ways in which we erect monuments and memorials and try to imprint our names and our lives in iron and stone. So we have a deep longing to be remembered, but really an incredibly limited capacity for any of these practices of public remembrance to sustain memories. We're not very good at that. So I've been looking at sort of both ancient, medieval, and even modern practices of public remembrance, and even some of the ways in which they have sort of theological bearing on our lives.
Well, excellent. Well, that sounds fascinating, and I hope maybe we can have you again.
Oh, I'd love that.
When you complete it. Well, again, thank you very much, Jay, for giving so much of your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's an honor, and I appreciate your interest and your encouragement, and it's been a really great time. Thank you so much.
This has been the Christian Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University, the host for the channel. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll come back and listen to another podcast soon.